my philosophy is, I will give my heart and soul in poetry to one person as energetically as I would give it to 100 people. So, I'm Leona Welch, and I'm from Richmond, California. I'm going to answer some questions that people usually ask me. I'm just going to answer them in advance before I get started on my poetry. And I usually want to know, who are you? Why do you write? When did you start writing? What kinds of statements do you make, and who's your mama? My mother I'm going to talk about in a little while, my mother and father. But I think I've been writing poetry most of my life. I haven't been writing professionally too long. 1971 is when Black Gibraltar was published, my first volume. I remember in seventh grade writing poems, and I remember having my teacher say, "That's real good," or "You really know how to make similes," or "I can really feel the snow on my nose." I can really smell the flowers, and these kinds of things encouraged me every time they wrote something, which is why, as a teacher, I'm very, 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 very careful about making positive comments when I ask my students to write. It wasn't until I got it, well, I was married, that I actually started taking it very seriously. I was listening to Nikki Giovanni. She was very popular in the 60s, and I was listening to her read, and she was saying some of the things that I, welcome, thank some you. Of the things that I was feeling, and I said, well, why am I not saying mine? And what happened was something that I could never have told anyone was going to happen. There was a book of poems in me, obviously, and I didn't know it. I knew that I had all kinds of feelings, thoughts, and ideas, but once that happened, and I made that commitment, I'm going to say mine, it seemed as though something opened up, and then all these poems came out. I was writing during the night. I was getting out of bed writing. Everything I thought was a poem. Everything I heard was a poem. Everything I breathed was a poem. Within, and this is no exaggeration, within about a month, I had written this, but I hadn't planned to be published. I was just writing. And I went to a poetry reading. And when the man finished, I said to him, would you look at some of my stuff? I really enjoy writing. He said, hey, you're gonna read before the day is over. And I read. And there was a woman there who heard me and said, would you come to my classroom and talk to my students? And I said, of course, I'll do that. I went, and there was a woman there who heard me in the classroom, who said, I'm from Les Wing Press in San Francisco. Well, we would like to hear your poetry. We would like to see your, why don't you bring it all to us? And I did. And from a month from the time I started writing to the time I started going around doing readings, this was published. Now, it doesn't happen that way for everybody. It probably won't happen that way again for me, but that's how I started. Why do I write? I just have a passion for it. I'm just one of these people who have to articulate my feelings. I never go looking for stuff to write. I don't think I've ever gone looking for material for my plays, nor for my poetry, nor my essays. I write for newspapers, commentary, as well as educational journals, religious magazines, and many anthologies. So, before I go into my poetry, did I leave anything out? I'm going to talk about my mom in a minute. Did I leave anything? Does anybody want to know anything else about how you got into this? Or is this the point in which I get into the poems? Okay. All right. Speaking of my mama. I'd like to start this by introducing, I'm going to talk to you as I read, okay? I'd like to let you know where all this that's in me came from. That's very important to me. My mother, Eileen Nicholas. I was born in Mobile, Alabama a few years ago, and I grew up there. I've lived in California 25 years. I grew up in a family of 9 children. This is a scene, a very common scene in my house. My mother liked to drink Lipton tea before she went to bed, and I made it. She liked to, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this term, but grease her hair with Vaseline. That's oil, you put it in your hair to keep the scalp, and we call it grease in your hair. Some people call it oil in your hair. And she used Vaseline because we use it for everything, right? This is a picture of my mother. It's called Love Was, Warm Kitchen Vapors and Midnight Smells. I got hungry and got up. She was there, sipping Lipton and greasing her hair. I got hungry and got up. She was there. Some white potatoes in a sack, she said, while she rubbed Vaseline in her head. Fried potatoes good before going to bed. They got hungry and got up. We were there, sipping Lipton while she greased her hair. French fries soaking on a brown paper bag. What's left over from what I had? Warm kitchen vapors and midnight smells. Sipping Lipton. She cares. Passing fries. I care. Biting one and passing it on. They care. Because she was sipping Lipton and greasing her hair. I want to talk about my father. My father died about 5 years ago. But I want you to know who John Nicholas was before I read this poem, these next two poems. A very loving man, known for being a man who smiled a lot, laughed a lot, talked a lot. He was an orderly in a hospital, the same hospital for 45 years. And on the side, my father used to, I always said he should have been a doctor. And I knew that the day he brought home a penicillin shot and gave us one when we had a cold. He used to do that sort of thing. But in any case, he was, well, I guess you would say to supplement the income, he would serve the doctor's staff meetings. And my father was a handsome man. I should have brought his picture. He's a good-looking man. And we were always impressed with the way he looked when he left the house. Black pants, white shirt, you know, with the Argo stiff starch collar, black bow tie. He used Vitalis in his hair. And he always smelled good and looked good. That's one fact you need to know. Another is, he called me a nickname, which nobody on this earth is ever allowed to call me but him. It was Jemima. Now, you're familiar with Aunt Jemima on the pancake box, right?
Yeah.
Well, I would go to bed with rollers in my hair and tie a scarf on. And then he said, I look like Jemima. So that's all he ever called me. All right. This is called Daughter of a Prince. He rubs the last smidgens of Vitalis into the softness of his wavy, luster black hair, straightens the already straight black bow tie, hooks it securely into the Argo stiffness of his white shirt collar and smiles. Soft generosity set in his face, he asks, how much, Jemima? 50 cents, I hold back. Cause Daddy might need his money. There. One hand reaches for the chiffonier keys, the other points at the pile of loose change on the dresser. There must be a whole $2 there, and he would give it all to me. Loose leaf notebook paper only cost a nickel. I stand teasing myself with the shine of pennies, nickels, and dimes. But more, far more entrancing at the moment, it is the shine of the man. He stands, a prince with Vitalis and aftershave surety, regal stature and royal sapience. He knows the smell, the stance, the movement of dignity. He is a prince, the tan white gleam of his skin smooth and seeping clean makes him so. The keys to the old freedom wagon are his scepter as he turns to leave the room. His gait, swift, aimful, and supreme, marks his processional air. He has to go and serve. I return to the coins and secure 50 cents, because Daddy might need his money. Royalty encompasses me. I am rich. Some because I stand with 50 cents in my palm, some because I stand in his room, redolent of sweet alkaline and soap. but more, much more. I am rich because I stand in the life of this man. I stand in his shine. Today he is gone, yet I am still rich. I am the daughter of a prince. Now, when my father died, the Archbishop of Mobile did his funeral in the cathedral. It was very close to him. And he was known throughout the land for a man whose floor you wanted to be on when you went to the hospital. People would come from miles, and the saying was, put me on John's floor. And he had a way with people whenever there are there any nurses in here, people in hospital work who understand and knows patients? Well, they can get ornery sometimes. And when that happened, they would say, get John in here. And he had this way of just walking in and saying, I mean, there was this archbishop who was very unruly when once the story was told. And my father just would walk in and say, no, Archbishop. He would say to me, no, Jemima. They would say to my mother, no, Aline. I mean, what can you say when someone just says, no? You just straighten up your act and that's it. He had a sort of a tone about him. So the Archbishop told this story about people wanting to be put on John's floor. And I wrote these poems a month, in fact, after my father died. And I wanted to capture that, and so I wrote John's Floor. On Providence Third Hall, there walked a man who answered the call. He had a way with the sick and the pained. They all seemed to know his name. His story goes beyond the door and hospital walls and John Nicholas's floor. It's the story of a heart-healing man who went about life with a smile in his hand. We remember the man with a smile in his hand, offering it to others, the least of my brothers. We remember the man with a smile in his hand. His work never halted. He who is humbled shall be exalted. Think of this man with his smile in his hand, sometimes down, yet giving his best. Seek ye first God's righteousness. God spoke to the man with a smile in his hand. My servant, labor no more. O Lord, we implore, when we labor no more, please see that we get on John Nicholas's floor. Okay. This comes from a piece that I'm about to get published when I find a publisher. I know it's going to happen. It's called, actually it's an anthology. I'm sorry, it's a volume of my poems called Loving Pieces of a Poet. And this is the title poem, Loving Pieces. This is about bits and pieces of me that are given here and there. Pieces of love move in and out of me in full and constant cycle. Some moments flowing and ebbing soul style, others spilling over on demand, gut-wise. Pieces of love move in and out of me. Pieces often scattered, yet never untogether. This piece, my woman's song, my song personified, it is alive. She comes, now cycloned, and again soft breeze blown. This music in my veins, it speaks my woman name. Another piece, this one, man's song, coming on, ebony strong, gentle at my side, sweet pieces set afire as I wrap my love about his breath and we become the air. Pieces of me, of poems, taking human form. Poems moving through my bowels as I sing out loud, God, let there be life. Poems, smile, cry at me. These pieces move near, calling me mother dear. Loving pieces of a poet, the summons to teach, to cry, to sing, to shout, to love, to hold on as the music moves, now in ebb, then overflow, to hold on as these poems these melodies merge, and my songs move toward whole. Hey world, I'm touching you. Feel me, world. Warm finger flesh pins across your chest. Silent sachet sounds. Hey world, I'm touching you. Feel me, world. Warm finger flesh pins panting and pulsating pentameters caught up in your breath. I'm wild weed, wig wearing, or cheek perfume. I'm jasmine, jergens, or afro sheen. Me, world, as I write what is me. Hey, world, I'm touching you. Feel me, world. Cyclone, light breeze blown. Me, world, loving you as I write what is me. Hey, world, I'm touching you. Okay, at this point, is there anything I've read or I wanted to stop? If there's anything you want to make any comments on, talk about, ask about. You just want me to go on? All right. Do the theme for which I came. Black Gibraltar. I want to tell you about Mary J. McDade. And this is why Mary J. McDade was the beginning of my love affair with older people. I didn't realize what was happening at the time when I met her. She's been dead about 15 years. She's an old black woman. At the time, my husband and I had two children, little ones, and we lived in back of her. And Mrs. McDade told me she didn't know how old she was. And I used to sit in her room listening to her. I'm getting all this wisdom, all these new ideas, and I'm thinking, and according to statistics, they don't even know this woman exists. So I used to write poems about her, and I would take her to my poetry readings. And I said, okay, well, they don't know, you're not on the records, but they're gonna know who you are. So I would sit her in the front, and I would read my poems, and I would have her stand. So one day an article came out in the newspaper about Mrs. McDade and about me, and I read it to her. She couldn't read. And she said, girl, child, you're going to make me feel like Miss Ann around here in a minute. Well, we know who Miss Ann is, right? Miss Ann has money and she's popular. But I said, but you're Mrs. McDade, and I want the world to know that. She was the first person to actually feed my six-month-old. And I tell you why I said that. I'm giving you a story here. I left my baby with her. One day, he was 6 months old, and I took the junior food, you know, the little jars of food that you pack in the, of course, six-month-old baby's still eating junior food, right? Well, when I got back, 3 hours later, the jar of junior food was still in the diaper bag. And I said, oh, no, she didn't feed him. And I said, Mrs. McDade, wasn't he hungry? She said, child, that baby didn't want that stuff. She said, that boy was hungry. She said, I chopped up some of them greens and pulled some of them bones out of that fish and I fed that boy. And she said, he ain't whimpered yet. She said, you take that stuff home and don't give it to me. I said, yes, ma'am. So I took my baby home, made from there. I was eating fish and greens. That's the kind of wisdom. But basically, one of the things she said a lot, and I heard all my life, was this: you got to live and let live. Okay. What that meant before to me was, I don't get in your way, you don't get in mine. But she gave it a beautiful, positive feeling. It was, I will allow you to live. I will make it possible for you to live, and you will make it possible for me. So when I said, how much do I owe you for babysitting, her answer was always, child, we got to live and let live. So that's Mrs. McDade. Her hair has become like the gray of an ageless Mississippi moss. Her face wears the emblem of fulfilled years, unrewarded. And time is unaware that she is there. Her yesterday brings no celebrations for today. And her today is a collection of yesterday's faded, dry-rotted doilies, locked tight in a stale, snuff-scented room. And time is unaware that she is there. an untaught scholar with a human degree in live and let live, and time is unaware that she is there. I want to couple that with this other poem.
It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think that's beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm going to show you another picture of her. This was not actually Mrs. McDade herself, but like I said, this is where my love affair with older people began. I was in the laundry, and I saw a picture I've seen all my life. I saw an old black woman with a heavy coat on a warm day, carrying a brown paper bag. Have you seen her? My grandmother used to say, when I say, why take the umbrella, why take the coat? She would say, honey, a wise man leaves his, a fool takes hers. I found out later what that meant. We called her a fool, but it rained, and she had an umbrella. So I saw this woman, and I took a piece of brown paper bag that I bought some potato chips, and I wrote this poem. I like to go in and out of rhyme sometimes, as I feel the need, and this poem picks that up. Old black woman trudging down the street, heavy brown paper bag, sore tired feet, covered a million years times 10 million more, lived a million lifetimes trudging to and fro, head rag tied over gray kinked head, back bent dragging on, heart full of lead. What is she toting in that big brown bag? A ton of bitter black bread for every year she's had. Tired old woman, weary in your soul, lay your paper bag down. Let your tale be told. And that's Mrs. Mary Jane McDade. Now I want to get into just some poems that will take you back to my childhood, but first of all, I need to know, anybody here from the South besides me? Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Texas. Am I the only Southern?
Texas,
okay. You might see some imagery. I don't know. Is there anyone here who has passed through those states, spent enough time there, that you know the flavoring of a state at all, as far as pecan trees and fig trees and sugarcane fields? Any of those things. Okay. All right, then I'm going to take you back through just for a few minutes. This is called Happiness Wobbs. Now, I grew up Catholic. I'm not anymore, but I grew up Catholic. And there are some images here that you might be familiar with. Grew up in a family, for those who came in late, a family of nine. Happiness was children playing in the attic. And it still is. Happiness was a faded blue uniform skirt, three sisters outdated, a rundown brown Plymouth, 10 years outdated. Happiness was China berries and pop guns on Saturday evening, squeezing in one more venial sin on the way to clearing the air. It was the Booker T Theater on a stormy Sunday evening. It was crabbing for a pot of gumbo, shaking down a forbidden pecan tree and running with the goods. Happiness was laughing when someone else got your whipping and feeling bad about it later. It was three dirt rings behind one-third tub of bath water and a piece of octagon soap. It was not telling who wet the bed, or fighting for the last chicken wing, ending up sharing it three ways. Happiness was a beat-up rocking chair out under a fig tree loaded with rotten figs, a rain-puddled chicken yard in bare feet, stepping over already stepped-in chicken's pride. Happiness was mama, waiting until you got in bed and asking if you wanted a piece of cake she had just brought back from sodality meeting. It was Monday evening novena on the church steps, and cheating the Lord out of half his allowance on Sunday morning. The donut shop. Happiness was daddy, running around with no shirt and very little pants, barbecuing over a crass relic of a wash pot pit. Happiness was Wingate Beach and a stomach full of fried chicken washed down with salt water. It was a newspaper umbrella, rolled up jeans, adventurous toes on a 200-degree pavement, Happiness was stealing honeysuckle juice from a hungry bee and daring him to get mad. It was a mosquito hawk on a clothesline. It was playing after dark by the light of lightning bugs and rewarding them with a short mason jar prison term. Happiness was the Big Dipper from the back porch and finding the entire universe. Happiness was this and more. It was me, you, them, they, y'all. Happiness was us. Did anybody go home?
Yeah.
The lightning bugs. Did you put them in the mason jar? And
yes.
You know, I miss that. I often see that in my head at night playing. And is there any place else besides the South that they have those?
Washington, D.C.
Have them here, don't they?
Yeah, in Washington.
Minnesota?
So you see, we are on one ground, aren't we? Okay. Now that I'm on a nostalgic trip here, I probably should do another nostalgic poem. But I won't right now. This poem. Some of you can relate to it, some of you might not be able to. A lot of people call this their favorite poem in the book. It wasn't meant to be too serious, but it did make a point. This book was written in 71. When black women were beginning to, I've worn my hair in a natural now since 71. I haven't seen a straightening comb since. But my friends still do, and my daughters do too from time to time. However, I was coming out of that mode. So I wrote fried hair and boiled collard greens. Mama in the kitchen straightening sister's hat. Daddy on the back porch hollering, get through in there. Got to straighten sister's hair, Easter speech to say. Daddy pacing in the yard, ain't we going today? Fried hair and boiled greens heaped up on a plate. Makes no difference about the hair, just so long it's straight. Something. What we'll do, living a white world scheme. Even if it means eating fried hair in your greens. So you can make this statement without getting too serious. My father hated it with a passion. He'd come home and say, you're still doing this? But he couldn't say too much because it was my grandmother who was his mother. So he couldn't say too much, so he just had to pace the floor. The Mardi Gras. I want to tell the truth about the Mardi Gras. It's time that the myth was dispelled, that people know exactly where the Mardi Gras came from. Raise your hands if you think it came from New Orleans. You don't dare, do you? Because you know I'm from Mobile, right? Well, I looked in the archives of a museum. I looked in a museum when I went home for Christmas. I'd heard this myth and this argument that the Mardi Gras began in New Orleans. The Mardi Gras began, now repeat this after me, in Mobile.
Mobile,
right? Okay, now everybody knows that. The people from Holden will take that information to the world. Okay. What happened was it grew larger in New Orleans because New Orleans was known for its jazz and, you know, and a lot of things that really made it, Louis Armstrong, how can you fight that, right? However, we celebrated Mardi Gras in Mobile. It was a big thing, 2 weeks of it, partying, parades in the street. Now, this is another look at the Mardi Gras. As a child, I enjoyed the running and playing. It was just great, eating the candy and throwing the serpentine ornaments, chasing floats. As an adult, I look back on it and I saw another message. And that's what we poets do, we see something else to it. It's not there, we don't make it be there. But in either case, this was there for me. There was the black Mardi Gras and the white Mardi Gras. And the white Mardi Gras was the bigger one, grandiose. The black Mardi Gras was very fine. It's just that it was on the black side of town. And what black people did for the white Mardi Gras was to serve. The balls. I don't know why I put these pieces of paper. All they're doing is confusing me. Is there anyone here who's been to the Mardi Gras? okay? Now I'm going to ask the next question. And when you answer it, you can either sit down or you could be on your way out the door. Where did you see it? In New Orleans?
New Orleans.
That's all right. It's okay. It's okay. Okay. You would think that for someone who published a book about how many years ago?
They know where the poems were, right?
I do this every time. Okay. It's on page 17. Sorry about the waste of time. Streets cluttered with serpentine ornaments, confetti, and broken hearts. Black neighborhoods lit up and alive. Black hearts sing and dance and act up. Black souls cry, but don't know it. Black concession, black children play tag, chase floats. Black children cry, but don't know it. It's Mardi Gras time, y'all. It's Mardi Gras time down south. Black bands striking up, black legs striding, stepping high, feeling low, but don't know it. Concessionists bargaining peanuts, 1 for 9, 3 for a quarter. Black mollies, called black clowns called mollies, boofing away troubled minds and quipping away at reality through bottles of 100-proof whiskey. Contrasting with bourgeois in satin shirts, masked face, and showing off on undersized ponies, throwing peanut butter kisses to children and saccharin kisses to women. It's Mardi Gras time down south. It's time to dress up, watch the parade, and drink. It's time to not care. It's time to be seen, time to hide, time to cry, but no one knows it. Everyone's out tonight, furbished, filly-fallied, and incognito to the toe. It's Mardi Gras time down south. It's forgetting time down south. It's crying time down south. But tonight, nobody knows it. And that's what it was all about. Let's see here. I'm going to go through now, page by page. Okay, I got to say something about this. I'm going to read two poems. One is the before and one is the after. I had a play done at a theater in Oakland called the Berkeley Black Rep, I'm sorry, Berkeley, called Black Through the Looking Glass. It was my version of. And it's done with poetry and humor and some, you know, the drama, dance, song. And in it, black woman is coming from a place where she believed the myths and the lies that I was not beautiful, to a place of waking up and looking at myself again, to a point of ultimately loving who I am and daring anyone not to allow me to. So this first poem I'm going to read is before, and the second poem is an after. The first poem is, well, I won't explain it any further. Any questions at this point? Any comments? All right.
Comments are, I love it.
Beautiful.
Thank you. Is there anyone who wants to, lost in time. Is there anyone who wants to share any stories out of your life at this point? I don't like to take the whole time. If there's anything that you want to say at any point when I read something and you think of something and your mind goes back into something, speak up. Okay, this is called Lost in Time. This is the before. This is the searching, in fact. Where am I? Where can I be? I cannot seem to find me. For years I did not dare search. Now I must search. Where am I? Beneath this copied coat of red, rouge, and blue eye cover, I must be there somewhere. Under this wig of platinum fake, let me find me for my black sake. Hidden in blotches of nagnoa and skin base, I must be there. But where? Is this my face? Help me hunt beneath this made-up mask of mock beauty. Help me hunt and find me, my black brother, my dear black father, my black lover. Help me cleanse my soiled, self-rejected skin and find me within. Tell me that I am woman refined. Help me know this true image of mine, that pure black luster of such kind that needs no reds and blues and flashing signs. Need only to know that I am woman defined in depths of beauty unfold. Help me to know me, my black brother, my dear black father, and then my black lover, love me as I be. And now, me alone, alone with me, no one else, me by myself. Learning, thinking, reflecting on me, no one else, me by myself. Once I hated the likes of me and looked for me in everyone else, now I see and love what I see, in love with me as I see myself. I call that my vanity poem. Aren't we entitled? In the Mood for Love?
That's right.
All right. I think they juxtaposed these poems on the pages here for a reason. I was sitting one night trying to be Shakespeare, I think. I was trying on some language that really wasn't my language, but I thought, well, I can deal with this language thing. Then I decided I'd say the same thing in down-to-earth words, and so I didn't know they were going to put it in a book this way. They saw it. They caught it. It's called Of Love and Wine. Offer me no love straight from the bottle. Bitter, hot, tangy, and tight. Drunkening now and never lasting. But lover mine, give me love as we have known love. Light and sweet as red wine. Offer me your love in a crystal gold goblet. Touched by wine wet fingers. Warm and tantalizing. And when we both have sipped and known the intoxicating taste of each other, my lover, empty then the sweet juices from your cup into mine, and we will drink as one and be filled. Not Shakespeare. This is Leona. It's called Prelude to Love. I think it's got about 20 words in it. We're all grown-ups here. Oh, okay. Your hands, my baby, your hands. My face, your hands. My lips, your hands. My neck, your hands. My breast, your hands. Your hands, your hands. Oh God, your hands.
And leave to your imagination.
I have to be sure when I read this, I'm in an adult audience. I was reading in a junior high school one day and I looked at this poem, I said, whoop. But then juxtapose that, just, you know, just say the same thing. Okay, all right. Black Dawn. Now, I'm going to tell you something about this poem that I personally didn't believe could happen. I dreamed it. Now, I thought that was just a bunch of malarkey. Incidentally, what is malarkey? I mean, I've often heard that. I don't know what it was. Okay, is it the same as baloney? Yeah, okay. And I thought people who said that, you know, they wanted to seem poetic and deep and involved and in control of this art. Well, it happened to me. And since then, I have written songs in my sleep. I couldn't capture them, keep them. I have written stories. But this is the only thing that I wrote, and when I woke up, I wrote it down just as it came. I didn't work on it. You believe this? Listen. It's called Black Dawn. And then came the dawn. Creeping, crawling, nearly not coming, yet coming on. Stretching, yawning, turning away from yesterday, coming on, still dawning, a new day dawning, awakening to a tranquil awareness, yet aware. Awakening from a barbiturated sleep, a sleep black and suppressed by dreams, dreams suppressed. Dreams of black came the dawn. On came the dawn, awakening, shaking, pacing, pacing the buff self-reflecting floor of an earth yet to be inhabited, demanding and ready to take demand. Along came the dawn, brightening to a day of beauty and lightning and black came the dawn. And then came the dawn. And then the dawn came. A dawn, breaking into a day, breaking into a full run, running and never waiting for another dawn, running past days gone by, running toward days to come. On came the dawn, like a bolt of black lightning it came, exposing earth, exposing her for all she is worth and not worth, exposing her good, her bad, exposing it all. On came the dawn, unbarbiturated, righteously belligerent, and black came the dawn. And that's the way I dreamed it. Just like that. I got mad, we fussed. You got mad, we cussed. My love, your love. How much? How much? I calmed down, we kissed. You calmed down, we touched. My love, your love. Too much, too much. That's called too much. SST and BS. I was reading the newspaper when they were talking about the supersonic air thing, and I just decided I want to respond to it. I don't often respond to usually comes right out of me, and I don't often respond to television and radio as far as my poetry is concerned, because the things of that nature are already in here. But I decided to answer this, and I at this time I was really down on Superman, because of what he stood for to me at the time. And now Superman has he's made a comeback. I got rid of him. Anyway, Superman is dead. He was too weak to survive the kryptonic tremors of a changing world, so they created the SST. Every little bit hurts no more. Supersonic air transport provides us with undreamed of opportunities. They who decide our fate have already picked out our burial plots. They offer us free radiation treatments while we fly the friendly skies ununited. They increase our daily dose of pollution, no Medicare needed. They build freeways in the sky and decide our fate. These leaders, who have exhausted intelligence and bought us all round trip tickets to disaster. They throw moon dust in our eyes and build SSTs, never consulting our dreams. Every little bit doesn't hurt, it only kills. Okay, this is another outside stimulus here. There was a movie on TV, and the woman was a has-been movie star. And she was sitting there trying to trying to make a comeback. And she was drinking her problems away. And I thought, okay, I'm going to write a poem for you, woman. So I did. It's called Psychedelic Hopes. And this is what she might have said. Life smiles at me and says, someday. Guitars pick away at my dreams. Drums beat out my time. Tambourines shake the breath out of belief. Life smiles at me and says, someday. Scotch and water, mingled with smoke, cheap wine, and psychedelic silhouettes, mingled with neon boulevards, signify my doom. A part, one part, all of me for a part of it, and life smiles at me and says, someday. I don't know if you can see the pictures here, but this is a wino. That's what they called him. Okay? That was the term in those days. When you saw him sitting on the side of the thing, they called him a wino. So that's what I'm going to call him for now. But today, we might very well recognize him as a homeless person. In those days, everybody who sat by the roadside with a bottle, brown paper bottle, bag with a bottle in it was a wino. I wrote a lot of poems trying to understand them. This is called Tag. In the company of great names and brilliant minds, he sits alone, supporting a Fillmore cornerstone. Cigarette butts, cursed empties, crushed paper cups, stray dogs, sidewalk hotel stench, 3 a.m. fog. He scours his stagnant mind, seeking refuge from mankind, playing hide and seek with a bottle of wine. Accomplishers and high-class folk glare and hold on to their nose, unaware that what they're seeing there is a Hughes, a Monk, and a Muhammad Ali, sitting reviving their soul. He sees the world in shambles of red and his own in constant chide, so he becomes a cornerstone. And in seeking, he chooses to hide. Okay, I had a nightmare. And in this nightmare, I dreamed that they were trying to kill soul. Now I'm talking about the soul, not the soul, because with that stage you're gone, it's... But soul as black folk know it. That certain feeling, the certain way you walk, you talk, you eat your food, you spend your money. And I'm using some symbols here that, well, you'll see. This is called And I Dreamt. I dreamt that the world was a Fox Plaza. There was no Davis Avenue, Rampart Street, or Buttermilk Bottom. I dreamt of overly super sophisticated black women, of black teenagers no longer dancing the boogaloo in theater lobbies, of black boys without transistor radios. The world was cold. I dreamt they were killing off soul. I dreamt that my grandmother threw away her recipe for crackling cornbread and that collard greens could no longer grow in American soil. And to simmer up a roaster of loud smelling chitlins was unlawful, punishable by a year's supply of shake and bake. I grabbed hold. I dreamt they were killing my soul. I dreamt of caviar instead of potato chips, playing bridge instead of tonk, eating cream peas and parfait, of salad forks and finger bowls. I dreamt of getting together with my friends and talking about Bernstein Stein instead of Ray Charles. I dreamt of Zuluism. I cried. I dreamt that soul had died. Oh, what a good bad day. If I woke up one day, my grandmother had said, I'm sorry, I ain't got no greens. It's against the law to grow them here. Okay. I found that a lot of children like this next poem. What time is it?
Who cares?
If I tend to go on, somebody go, okay? And if I don't hear you, go, okay. This is called Is Black Blood Red? Mama, is black blood red? Lorenzo Lafayette says, black blood ain't red. It's red for show, to know how many years have we unbled. Yes, son, black blood shone off as red. And that ain't all. It's proud and strong, rich and enduring. Run along. Mama, is tomorrow really today? When folks say tomorrow, are they talking about today? We doing things today we said we do tomorrow. We knowing things today that yesterday we didn't even bother. Yeah, boy, today sure enough is tomorrow. Mama, when is it justice? Huh? When is it justice? Lorenzo Lafayette says, it's when a thing is right. We come and go and don't even have to fight. That's right, little man, you're running fast. But more than that, it's just when we don't have a first and don't have a last, don't have poor and don't even have class. Many other things, my son. It's justice when it's right for everyone. Mama, mama, is black blood red? Oh, mama, is black blood red? There is no end to the question, right?
That's right.
The birth of freedom. Now, let me tell you when I wrote this poem. Mothers, raise your hands. Given birth, you've given birth. Okay, you've experienced labor pains, all right. Well, I just had Derek, our third child. And it was all brand fresh and new in my mind. And so I wrote this poem, and so you will feel the birth thing happening. This is called the birth of freedom. Freedom, freedom. I watch your life take shape. For time and too much time again, I awaited the day of your inevitable conception, led only by the copulation of justice and her mad lover, time. Now I await your procrastinated birth. I see the wound of a black habitat enlarged with the beauty yet fury of you taking form. I press my ear against the abdomen of an estranged people and hear the angry pounding heartbeat of a fetus too slow becoming. Now your day has come, your hour is upon them. Neither man nor his assumed powers can keep you unborn. You will come, announced by the claps of black thunder and the voices of your unwanted predecessors, slavery, rejection, ignorance, and deprivation. And from those who will cherish your life, now the masters of their manhood, let freedom claim. Pains of labor's timely contractions in the uterus of righteousness. Jolting to a frightful reality, those who sought to abort you when contracepting fell. The moans and groans of a hard, endured labor need never again be heard. Pushing, pushing, pushing. The vigorous, unforeseen strength of her who bore you. And in you, blackness is reborn. I searched me out and found that I was me. I listened to my heart cry out an urgent plea. Heard my soul sigh a searchful sigh, my very being ignited in fire, burning for human reality, yearning for true identity. I searched me out and found that I was me. This next poem, I think I saved it for last. Well, not last, or it depends on the time. I'm very conscious of that. How much more do I have? What time does the bell ring to do anything? The next thing?
Vespers.
Oh, we're moving on into Vespers already? Okay. Okay, I'm going to read this and one other one. I'm just wanting to be sure I covered everything I wanted to. I think I've read the whole book to you just about. See if there's anything in here that I didn't get to that's important to me. Inspiration. God looked down one cold, bleak day. He saw a man bent down to pray. He looked and saw a gray king's head, a worried black face, and here's what he said. My friend, I know you feel disgust. I even know you find it hard to trust. I'm aware that you're about to give up on me, but listen, my friend, when you do, you'll see. I was there when Emmett Till got hung from a tree. You see, they did the same to me. I heard the shots that halted Martin's work, and the bomb that exploded in that Birmingham church. And when you're scorned and treated unfair, I know you feel that I'm not there. I've counted the years they've trampled on you. I know what it's like. I was trampled on too. Would it help if I told you, dear friend, that I'm long since ready to see an end put to all this mess and fuss? You see, it's not just you. It's you and me, dear friend. It's us. You've bled, cried, and carried your load. You've sweated and traveled a long, rough road. I made you the color I wanted you to be. And I made you as all men in the image of me. A face looked up to heaven that day. And when he heard what his Lord had to say, he raised his voice in a loud, clear prayer. He said, Lord, I know you're there. You see, it's just that I hadn't heard. You hadn't spoken not a single word. But now, I feel like a brand new man. Lord, please don't never let go of my hand. Mm-hmm. Do I have time for one more?
Do it.
I'm going to use this book in my sessions, The Poetry and Drama of Growing Old. It's an anthology, but I'm only going to use my piece. My piece is unlike all the others in that these are 21 plays by contemporary black writers, 8 of us from the Bay Area, but mine is a choreo poem. It was put in here for its dramatic effect. And it was done at the University in New Hampshire. It was done in the University of Ohio. I haven't seen it done. But in this, I'm giving tribute to the hands of old black women and the roles they've played in their lives. The only thing I'm going to read today is the prologue. And I understand, I mean, they sent me the publicity and all the pictures and things, and I understand he did a beautiful job of it. There are 7 poems. Each of them predicts a role. I mean, each of them portrays, I'm sorry, a role. And it's dance, so the focus is on the hands. But I just want to read, this is actually, if I don't write anything else for the cause of women, age, black women, taking that individual parts and putting it together, however, I would have given a tribute in the place where I really needed to give a tribute. Okay. This is a dance poem, a moving poem, a poetic expression written as a tribute to old black women everywhere. This is their lost poem, the poem that got caught in the brambles the day before the harvest, the poem that became the tears after the crop was lost. This is the poem, the black woman poem that was misplaced in the shuffle up the hill to work and back down to soak 2 tired, lonely feet. This is the poem that moved, this is the poem that moved with the spirit from the wooden pulpit to the top of a nodding head and a constant and rhythmic amen. This poem has touched many a soft milk chocolate, tiny smiles, and cupped them in its hands. This poem has glided in soundless, doe-like fashion through open fields, tapped its feet in lighthearted exuberance, and held its breath at the edge of a million hopes. This poem is energy, dark and rich. This poem is motion as it is sound. Hear this beautiful old black woman poem whose meter and beat could have been the anxiety beat of a heart birthing a black child on a cold, rainy night in an Alabama black woods. This poem remembers backwards. This poem remembers the hands that started the breath, and it remembers the breath. This is their poem, old black women. Their dance, the dance whose movements waited and waited until the right day got there, waited too long and became too tired before they recognized the right to be movements in their own rhythms. This is their dance, their swirls and twirls of joy, of knowing a new day, a new dollar, and a new strength for daring. This is their dance, slow, stretching, turning, yearning, giving, living, as love moves inside and reaches itself outwards to those in their world. The poem and the dance are one with the woman. It is a tear dropped in the dark, a smile crossed with the